I'll make it on to.
I should say that at the beginning, I've known Scott for a long time, and I've learned so much from him, and he's been my my inspiration, and my, whatever he said, I go double, okay? So, a number of years ago, I spent a fall shooting trap with some friends of mine, and it's kind of a space-time problem. The clay pigeon comes up, and you have the shotgun, and you shoot not at the object, but in front of the object, and if the trajectory of your shot and the trajectory of the clay pigeon connect, and then you hit the target. So theoretically, you ought to be able to do that with Mars. You ought to be able to shoot a spaceship and figure out exactly where it's, where Mars is, and have Mars come around, and the spaceship should just hit Mars. But in fact, if you do that, you guarantee to miss Mars. And why is that? That's because Mars is on a completely different grid. Mars is not on the same, it's not in the same space that Earth is in. And the way we usually say that is to say that the relative velocities of Earth and Mars are such that special relativity concerns are crucial, and therefore you have to use the Lorentz transformation to make it work out. But what does the Lorentz transformation transform? It transforms the grid that's attached to Mars so that it looks like the grid that's attached to Earth. So really there are, even in the solar systems, there are many spaces in the same space at the same time. Now, this is a very sophisticated thing, but I understand it in a simple way. Think, consider it as a decision tree. You have three crossings, a knot with three crossings on the lower left, and you want to get to the point where there's no more crossings. You can insert a saddle shape, and you could do one, and then you could do two, and then you could do three, or you could start with two, and then do one, and then do three. And all those different possibilities are traced out in this cube. And speaking classically, we would say one of these is the route that was taken. One of these is the history of the event. But I believe this was meant to be a model of quantum phenomena. And so you can't say exactly for sure which route was taken. And it certainly seems to be true in many cases that more than one route was taken from the past to the present. So there are more events have multiple histories. And the problem with understanding quantum phenomenon is understanding how all these different spaces, how all these different timelines or world lines can all be laying one on top of another. So we see it as one line. And so I think in this circumstance also, there are many spaces in the same space. And this is my dog, Missy, and we have a very complete relationship, and I'm very happy with Missy, but when I start to talk to Missy about special relativity, this is the look I get. So I take this as an emblem that this is also our psychological reality. We are many people in the same space, many people in the same person. We have multiple roles to play, and so I think we are many people in the same person, many spaces in the same space at the same time. So that's where I start. That's my proposition. How do we depict, make a model for, have a way of experiencing the real situation that we are dealt, which is that the space of this room cannot be just infinitely extended as a three-dimensional bottom, and that fits all of our experience. So my first idea was to put the three spaces, three different spaces side by side in a painting. And so I'd have a painting with a perspective space, or in the middle a bas-relief space, and on the end a flat space, a frontal space. I have three spaces in the same place at the same time, or at least three spaces in the same painting at the same time. And I like this painting a lot, but it's not very sophisticated implementation of the idea that I just laid out for you. Here's a more abstract version. It's actually a little bit earlier. And there's an attempt to try to integrate these spaces or somehow make the different spaces in the same place at the same time. But again, they're just juxtaposed. And then I had I started finding out about four-dimensional geometry. And I started studying physics as a way of learning four-dimensional geometry rather than the other way around. And then I found out about computer visualizations of four-dimensional figures. And this really changed my work. If you think of this painting as being a triptych, having hinges, and you fold the painting in upon itself, you start getting work like this. So you have a number of different planes that put the viewer in a number of different locations, and these planes are not only overlapped, but they're interwoven in ways that are paradoxical in three dimensions, but would be the natural consequence of being in four dimensions and being reduced, pressed, projected into three-dimensional space. And here's another example. Starting from here, you can elaborate and they become richer and richer. And there's another one picture of the same painting. Finally, they can get very, very complicated. And there's, like Scott's, the works that Scott just showed you, there's an attempt to define the space by tessellating hypercubes or portions of hypercubes. We've discovered that if I try to run these software that I wrote, it crashes the system. So I'm not going to show it to you, except to say that I actually believe that this is the first computer visualization of hypercubic tessellations. And I have a little story to tell. I was racking my brains. How would you fit hypercubes together? And if you just sort of say it that way, it's impossible to answer. But I had a way of writing to Coxeter, and I wrote him, how do you tessellate hypercubes? He wrote me back this like four-sentence letter with a little diagram, and it was completely clear. You just tessellate forward and backward and up and down and in and out and forward and backward in the fourth dimension. So that's what I did. So every cube is a cube in precisely two hypercubes. And it's a nice program. Yeah, actually, you can download it from my web. It's a very primitive program. And I got another idea from playing with those programs. There's a feature of, you can rotate, you can rotate a, here I am. You can rotate a piece of paper around a point, two-dimensional. You can rotate a three-dimensional object, let's say a stick, around a line. And you can rotate a four-dimensional object around a plane. And this is something that was actually known at the end of the 19th century. I discovered the guy who wrote this paper about it. But we didn't really understand what that meant and how it looked and how it behaved until we put them on computers. And so what I found was a very low-tech way of showing planar rotation. I suppose, strictly speaking, it's not. But you have two-dimensional objects, painted lines, and three-dimensional objects, welded steel rods, and I've gone to a lot of trouble so that you can't really tell which is which unless you move. And then when you move, they rotate and they behave, they hide, cells can be hidden behind planes. The sort of visual phenomena you see when you're playing with the hypercube on the computer. The one difference is that the plane of rotation is not in the origin. The plane of rotation is a face of one of the cells. And you don't get all of the effects, but you do get some. And then there's something else that's going on here where I'm trying to make a model of the non-Euclidean surface. But I got another idea, which was that since the three-dimensional objects and the two-dimensional objects taken together provide the visual information of a four-dimensional figure, wouldn't it be elegant to have the two-dimensional figures be the actual cast shadow? In other words, the three-dimensional objects and the two-dimensional objects are the shadow of the fourth dimension. So why not have the two-dimensional objects be the shadow of the three-dimensional objects, and those items taken together be the shadow of the four-dimensional figure? So these works from 86, you can wear 3D glasses, kind of look at glasses, and you take the red image and the blue image and fuse them together. So now you have two things in the same place at the same time. And as you pass by, they rotate against one another in ways which are characteristic of planar rotation. I guess I should have explained that this is a relief sculpture. This is welded steel, and it's lit by a red light and a blue light. Where they shine together, they make the white light. Where you block out the red, you get a blue line. Where you block out the blue, you get a red line. And that's why you have anaglyphic glasses. So these works attempt to show planar rotation as a way of learning to see four-dimensional space as a way of having a model for our experience. And I went on from there to study quasi crystals, which it turns out are also projections of more regular structures in higher dimensional space. And here again, if I run the program, it crashes, so it won't. But here below you have a dome. Right above it you have the plan of the dome, or the shadow of the dome at noon. And you can see the five-fold symmetry. To the left is the shadow at 10 in the morning, and to the right is the shadow of 2 in the afternoon, and you have threefold, fivefold, and twofold symmetry in the same object. And to me, that was many spaces in the same space at the same time. I got a chance to build a large-scale quasicrystal in Denmark, and you can see the shadow on the floor. And it really did work that you walked around the structure above and below, and there was a bridge that passed through the structure, and you would sort of see this kind of mess of stuff, and then you would take a step and all of a sudden it would become something made out of triangles, and then you kind of walk around, oh, it's something made out of squares, and something made out of star pentagons. Here's another photograph. A wonderful thing about quasicrystals is, of course, all the nodes are the same in the same orientation, all the rods are the same length, all the planes are the same plane. They make cells of only two kinds. They make subassemblies of only four kinds, three more than one. And there's all this incredible, they're in rows and columns. There's all this incredible standardization, and yet we have an aperiodic structure with simultaneous five-fold, three-fold, two-fold symmetry. Is somebody here in Denmark? Was it they might have known. George Francis has been trying to implement this in the cave, and I guess the student who's made the most progress was Matt Gregory, and it's now sort of implemented in the cube. I know Scott saw it. I haven't had a chance to really see it yet. But this could be just really a fascinating mathematical tool for changing initial parameters, seeing how the quasicrystal breaks apart and reforms itself in a different configuration, and really understanding the subassemblies and how they work, and being able to walk through this thing and pick out parts of it. It's a great way to see quasicrystals. And after the Denmark project was finished, I started doing some more paintings like my first paintings, except that now the planes are lattices, three-dimensional lattices, and they're all twisted and curved, and I suppose this really comes out of conversations with Scott and trying to read his books and thinking about grading surfaces. You know, if you have a two-dimensional sheet and you want to treat it not as a ribbon but as a sheet, and you want to tie it in a knot, you have to have access to four dimensions. You have to be able to go over and under itself. And if the sheet were to have a thickness and be a lattice, be identified with a color, maybe with an internal structure, such as a tessellated octahedra or dodecahedra, then you could sort of grade these in higher dimensional space, maybe five-dimensional space, and when they would be projected down into three-dimensional space, they would self-intersect, and you would have these impossible, twisted, impossible overlaying. And the painting is marvelous for that, because you can paint these transparencies. And so the goal is to try to see the lattices as separate entities, and then try to see multiple lattices, and to try to see them all intertwined and overlapping in paradoxical ways. I'll show you a few more. Maybe I'll settle on one. I recognize some stuff here, not. Let's take this one for example. Look at the orange line of their yellowish-orange line. This is a quasi-crystal pattern in the five-fold symmetry relationship. So these are cells, single cells of quasi-crystal. And another structure is the light blue structure, and their octahedra. Their octahedra is tessellated point to point, and they're bent in a kind of parabolic fashion, a kind of a nose cone. And can you see the red lines? Not so well, maybe, but there are red lines. They're two-cell groupings of hypercubes, in other words, two cells of a hypercube, and they are torqued in a hyperbolic parabola, and there are some light blue lines. They're dodecahedra, so there's a field of dodecahedra, and they're frontal. Then there's some other green lines, make little stars. That's a two-dimensional pattern of that comes from a Persian dome. And they are also sort of in this spherical cone shape. And all of these lattices and patterns are interwoven and pass through and over above one another. Here's the last painting that I'm going to show you. from 2005. Different patterns are more clearly visible. So that's, I'm going to end there. Unless you have any questions.
I think your work is beautiful, and I'd love to see it in person and just look at it for a while, because you start to see the different overlapping lattices. I'm curious about two things. What are the scale of your paintings in general?
These paintings are 56 by 70.
Okay. Yeah, that would be quite a different experience seeing it in person, right in front of it. And I'm also curious, I really like your line quality. Do you do that by hand?
I invented a tool, like a striking tool, like a mini roller, and the roll down.
Okay.
With a straight edge.
Interesting. And what about, I mean, because sometimes they're straight, but you also have this, you know, very slight curvature on some of the lattices.
Right.
Is that, each segment is still straight?
Right.
Okay.
So these aren't computer generated?
Well, the lattices are computer generated. And I also do some prints, which go directly from the computer through the internet to the printer. But these are sort of composed on the canvas and through a computer projector. So I have individual lattices, and the lattices can be, you know, then manipulated and. They're laid up one at a time, chalked in, and then painted in. And the lattices are generated by two different kinds of programs. One is a program that I wrote, and another is a program from England called Formula, which is a pattern generation program. It's a public domain program. And it's not user-friendly, it's hard to use. But it's very efficient in terms of, and it works in any dimension. It's oblivious to whether it's five dimension or 10 dimension or whatever. And there are many features for curving and warping. And so I use that to generate the patterns, the lattices, I should call them. Yes.
I'll ask the same question we asked Scott, which is, have you felt some sort of new relationship with 4D in your head?
Comes and goes. That's the honest answer. You know, there have been times when I... Heinz von Foster, I don't know if you know the name, he was a psychologist of perception, and he was a follower of Piaget, and he wanted to study the acquisition of visual comprehension, spatial comprehension in adults, and he thought a model for that would be, could they do this, could they learn four dimensions? And this is in the 70s, and he had this gigantic computer that he sat down and had, he looked through a little scope, and you would learn to see the fourth dimension. Now, according to Heinz, he could take anybody, undergraduate, and in 15 weeks flat, teach them to see the fourth dimension. He said, well, what does that mean? I said, well, could they do puzzles in the fourth dimension? Could they anticipate rotations? Could they distinguish between legal and illegal moves? And he had about five or six things that were his criteria. And according to him, anybody could do it. But, you know, I've asked this to Scott, and I've asked this to Benchoff, I've asked this to, you know, physicists and, you know, Penrose, I mean, and you always get the same answer. Right? You know, sometimes I think I'm giving. So the question is whether you're hardwired for three dimensions or whether it's a cultural experience. You know, and I spent a whole decades arguing that it's all cultural and that you can learn to do it.
You've got a large body of work from 2005 to the current. Do you have any more recent photos of?
I don't think I have any on here.
Yep. So when you project from the fourth dimension to three dimensions, you lose information. When you project four dimensions to two dimensions, you lose even more information. And then, you know, if you project down to a line, it's lost all.
Yeah, well, actually, I wanted to address what you said, which is that, well, wouldn't it be better if you had three dimensions? Right. And the answer is no, because you cannot do planar rotation in three dimensions, right? For example, this is an example from my book, but I think is this a
center of projection of the cube?
Are you sure? It's not four trapezoids and a square?
And also two heads.
Yeah, how could you tell the difference?
If you have a second image. And then
No. If you rotate it. Does that help you? No. Before you depend, let me finish. But if I had a cube, a real cube, and I projected it on the surface, and I were to rotate the cube in its own space, which is different from rotating the projection, and I will watch the change of the projection, then I would be able to tell whether it was a cube or whether it was a tile pattern. And so, actually, I think two dimensions, especially if you can make kinesthetic two-dimensional images, are more revealing than three-dimensional projections. Once you project it, it's done. It's fixed. It has no more information.
I'm astonished about the fact that this lady, the professor in Princeton, is more or less forgotten. He wrote descriptive geometry in four dimensions. Of course, also three dimensions, you cannot reconstruct from one picture. You need at least two.
So I know him. I mean, I know his book. I have his book. But he's not the only one. I mean, this goes way back.
It's 50 years ago.
Yeah, okay, it goes back, the first drawings of hypercubic figures and was 1880. But I agree, he's not on everybody's another question? Well, thank you very much.